Coming from the backwoods of New Jersey, welcome to the Jersey Guys Music Podcast, where we feature in-depth music discussions and interviews with special guests from the worlds of hard rock, heavy metal, and AOR music. So settle in and crank it up. Now, here are your hosts, the Jersey Guys themselves, Tom and Mark.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Jersey Guys podcast. I'm Mark Ballow here with my co-host, Tom Coyne. And joining us today all the way from Sweden is a singer who has quite the history. We're going to talk about all the stuff he's done. He's a guy that's played with some iconic British musicians. I mean, we're talking about guys like Don Airey, Lee Kerslake, Mickey Moody, Bernie Marsden, Neil Murray. But he also has his own band, Snakes in Paradise, that started back in the 1990s. So we're going to talk about all that stuff. But please welcome to the show, Stefan Berggren. Stefan, welcome.
Thank you very much indeed. It's I'm happy to be here. And I'll talk to some guys over the pond, you know.
That's right.
It's not every day. So you're in New York, yeah? Right?
In, are you in New York? New Jersey. Yeah.
Yeah, we're like about 30 miles, 35 miles out of New York City.
All right. Yeah. I did a rock opera in New York with a drummer called Corky Lang from Mountain.
Oh, wow.
I grew up on Mountain. That's how old I am.
Yeah. Leslie West on the guitar.
And Felix Pappalotti on bass.
Yeah, and Corky Lang was I had one of the bigger roles there, and Corky was handling the music, you know. So we were cast about 20 people. So we played on Park Avenue. It was Kane's Theater, you know.
Wow, how long ago was that?
That was a couple of years ago. I think it was 2017. Just before the pandemic, you know.
Okay.
So I spent a lot of time out in Long Island to rehearse.
Really? Mountain, okay. Interesting. Yeah,
Mountain used to rehearse over there as well. So.
Yes. Well, the band really originated from Queens and New York City. Yeah. Leslie West was from Queens, which borders on Long Island, and Pappalotti was a Manhattan guy. So the band really, and Corky Lang too. So the band really was from that area, literally from like, you know, even before that. West played in a band called The Vagrants that were very popular in the late 60s. They were all Queens musicians.
Yeah, cool. I liked it. There were a lot of places to play in Long Island that I heard, you know.
Oh, back in the 70s and the 80s, Long Island was a hotspot. Yeah.
Yeah, it had a really vibrant scene.
Yeah, from like the late 70s into the 80s. Yeah. I used to go out there as a kid and see bands. I saw Zebra there, and you know, there was a pretty vibrant area.
Yeah, how is it these days? Are there any rock?
Not so much, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, you get shows in Manhattan. A lot of the shows have shifted to Jersey. And there's a small pocket in Brooklyn where there's a lot of clubs, and it's a pretty vibrant scene, but it leans more toward strictly metal. It's not really, you know, like a melodic scene. It's a metal scene, which is fine by me. I've seen a lot of bands down there, but it's like small pockets of places. It's not like the way it was, you know, 30, 35 years ago. That's for sure.
Yeah, it goes back and forward, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Some places goes down and some places come up.
You know? Yeah, and it shifts all over the world. I mean, places that are real hot spots now weren't, you know, 35, 40 years ago. Yeah. You know? I mean, Sweden has propped up the scene for decades now.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's starting to come back, you know, quite big, you know, the rock thing, you know.
Oh, in Europe it is. Yeah, throughout Europe it really is.
You can play rock and roll, you can play metal, you can play, you know, Led Zeppelin type of music or AOR. So it's quite good times, you know, for music.
We'll talk about that. Let's start with your early band, which is Snakes in Paradise. It's a band that, I guess, and Tom and I were talking about this, there was an EP or a single that came out about 1993. The debut followed in 1994. How would you describe that band for people who don't know? Because even though it was something that sort of came out at the tail end of like sort of the American, I guess, quote unquote, hair band scene, it wasn't really that. It was more of an organic thing, more of a bluesy thing, more of a classic rock sounding band. How would you describe Snakes in Paradise sound?
I would describe it quite honest, you know, because in those days we recorded on tape, you know, on a tape recorder, and it's, you only had a couple of weeks to record stuff, you know. But we always, you know, were interested in the studios, and I think the first EP we recorded it ourselves, and it sold out, you know, immediately, and it became quite big in Japan. So we got a record deal immediately for an album. So we flew over Brett Walker. He was a guitarist, singer.
Sure.
I think he was from LA, but nice guy, you know. He helped us in the studio, and it was, in those days, there was no cheating, you know.
Yeah,
right. We had two weeks on it, and then he took the tapes to America and mixed it, you know.
Okay.
So we tried to, all these years, you know, with the idea with Snakes in Paradise was try to keep it organic and not too many fluffy keyboards. You know, we had the organ, we had piano, but try to find keyboard sounds that could stick, you know.
Right. Oh, it definitely has that sound, you know, like, is it, like you said, it is more organic. That's a very good word for it.
Yeah, we tried to, you know, we tried to find our own style. And in the end, we did, you know, when I hear those albums, we have our own sound, you know, and some plays on it is, yeah, quite unique, you know. So, but we were very inspired by American music and British music. So I guess it's a bit of Scandinavian rock.
Mm. Yes. Yeah. Like definitely a classic rock feel. Who would you say some of the inspirations were for you personally or as the band?
On those early albums, you know, I was really into Deep Purple, you know, and Led Zeppelin and
even like a Uriah Heep.
There were a lot of bands, of course, Whitesnake, you know, but
sure.
But we tried to. It's hard to say. Everything went so fast, you know. We started off as we were backing up a guy called Mark Free.
Oh, okay.
So we did a tour with Mark Free. He played. He sang in a band called with Carmen Appice.
King Cobra.
King Cobra.
King Cobra. Yeah. And he did a solo tour in the UK and France. So we did five or six shows. As you know, we were supporting him. You know, and they heard our first EP. I think there's a live album released by Mark Free, and Snakes in Paradise is the band playing with him, you know. Oh, and okay. I was playing the keyboards and sang the background vocals, so you can hear my pipes there in the background. Great singer, by the way, but I think it's a lady now. So
Mark Marcy, yes.
Mark turned into Marcy.
Fantastic singer. Anyway,
he was in a band called Signal. I don't know if you ever heard the album. It's one of the greatest pure AOR albums that's ever been recorded.
We played a couple of
Signal songs. Signal. Yeah, I mean, it's just.
Does it feel like love or something? Does it feel like love? Is that Signal song?
Yeah, Arms of a Stranger.
Yeah, we played Who Cries Now. So if you listen to Mark Free's live album, it's from the 90s. It's our band Snakes in Paradise playing.
Okay.
Now, Snakes in Paradise, in my opinion, now you could correct me if I'm wrong or if my timeline is off. I think with a first Swedish band from that second wave of the 90s to kind of crack the market. I mean, in the 80s, you had, you know, you had Treat and a whole bunch of, there was a big Swedish Scando scene.
Europe, of course.
In Europe. But of course, then we hit that 91, 92 brick wall, you know, with the change. And then came along this fourth track EP that I remember picking up that had the four original songs of Snakes in Paradise that got a big buzz with people, myself included. And like they really, that I recall that as being the first Swedish band that really brought forth what has been now like 30 years of great hard rock music from Sweden.
No, thank you. I think you're right about that. When we didn't think about that when we played, we just played. But now I can see, you know, 20 years later, we had something unique. And and you can still hear that when we did the latest album on Frontiers, you know. And I was a producer on that album. I wanted the same organic sound, you know. I wanted real drums. I didn't want to mess too much with the drums, you know. I just wanted a sound that when we played together, that's going to be the sound, you know, and not too much fixed with the computers, you know. So it's a bit, as you said, it's organic and honest, and that's the sound that we wanted. We wanted to, it's like Black Sabbath has an own sound, Deep Purple has an own sound. I think Snakes in Paradise has its own style as well, you know.
Yeah.
So you're right about that. I think we were a little bit ahead of our time playing that music. So if we would have waited, you know, 10 years later, it'd be...
Yeah, well, it's true, because the big, right. The big burst of all of those bands was to come probably a decade later. And then you had the bands before that were the bands that were at the tail end of the 80s, very early 90s, like Treat with Organized Crime. You know, they hit a home run with that album, which I think was like 89-ish. And then there was like a couple of years, there was nothing. And then, like I said, that four-track EP popped out. And I know myself, somebody had recommended it to me from a store, and I bought it, and I loved it. And then when I heard there was a full-length album coming out, and I remember in Burn Magazine gave it a big, really pumped it up a lot, gave it a really high, and it put it on the radar of everybody, is that this was like this band was a force now. Like it was like some, you know, to pay attention to.
Yeah. We didn't hear that, unfortunately, ourselves, because, you know, there were no internet back then, you know, it was quite difficult times in Sweden, you know, because Nirvana had come and Guns N' Roses. So it was a different style of music. We went down to Rhodes, to Greece, and we played in a rock club for 4 months, you know, after the release of the first album, you know. But it was nice, you know, to be down there. It was nice and warm, a lot of ladies, you know. And it was not affected by the Guns N' Roses and
right.
It was
Nirvana, but
still quite a nice vibe down there, and you know, a nice holiday place. We played it for 7 nights a week, you know.
Wow.
Played a couple of our own songs. We played a couple of Van Halen songs, and it was good times, you know, for rock school and learning the craft. You know, it was I didn't know what to expect. You know, you go down to a rock club in Greece for 7 nights a week, and you think this, and we did it for 4 months. You think, oh, is it supposed to? My voice is it's hurting, you know, but. Right. I learned a lot by it, you know, to control the voice and handle gigs. You know, sometimes we play 3-hour gigs, you know, and you have to be careful with the voice, you know.
Sure.
Now, us as American fans, we were kind of hoping and relying on the American bands to kind of bring this sound back, and it really wasn't happening. What was happening in America was the American bands that were still around were changing their sound to sound alternative, grunge, however you want to call it. And then we started to see this big explosion of other bands, you know, like Masquerade, Pole Position, Great King Rat, State of Mind, all these bands from whether it's Sweden or countries nearby that were coming out and were doing the traditional hard rock that we were familiar with. And that's why I said, like, you guys were at the forefront of what turned into like the Swedish sound, which today is still really what's pushing, you know, the great music through the whole country.
Yeah, you're quite right. I haven't thought about that. It's funny you mentioned Grey King Rat. I work with the singer there, Leif.
Oh, great singer.
He plays bass with me and sings a couple of songs, you know. So on my solo band sometimes. So it's a small world, you know. the circle is shut, you know. It comes around again.
Yeah.
Is that Allman Brothers?
Yes.
The poster, huh?
Yes.
Nice.
Yes.
Cool.
Good eye.
Fantastic band.
Yes, my all-time favorite band.
Yeah. I mean, I learned a lot from them, you know, Greg Allman and his brother, you know, Dwayne, and great posters in the background. Rory Gallagher, you know.
You got it. You see it, yeah.
favorite of Bernie Marsden. Rory Gallagher was Bernie Marsden's idol.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
No, he was really into Rory.
Just to digress, because you'd get me started on Rory Gallagher, I can turn the whole podcast into it, but I won't. the problem with Rory is he could never break the States, and it held him down. People to this day are still discovering Rory Gallagher as if he was a new musician, because he never broke the United States. I was lucky enough to see him in the States. He played a tiny club in Greenwich Village. And I saw him, but that's the type of places he would play when he occasionally played here. Then he'd go to Europe, and he was big in Europe.
Yeah, yeah.
He never could break the States. Gary Moore never really broke the States either. It was.
Didn't he? Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, that's weird.
Yep. Maybe a little bit more than Rory did, but Gary Moore would play clubs over here also when he played. When he was big, I'm talking like, you know, in the mid to late 80s. It was fun. But that's the thing with Rory. To this day, there are so many people that are just discovering how great this guy was, you know, and it was 40, 50 years ago.
You have quite, life is short, you know, you have only amount of time when you look good, yes. Great and you
right.
Perform. And you can always, most of the musicians that I know, you know, get better with age, you know. But you can't look like you did when you were 20.
Right.
I wish you could. But I think, it's all about promotion. In those days, you had to have really big contacts, you know. I mean, he had a talent for it, for sure, you know. And, the Allman Brothers wasn't so massive here in Europe, but these days, everyone knows them, you know.
Yeah.
So. Well, the Allman Brothers were the complete opposite. They were massive in the States, and they never caught on in. And like you said, they become over the years. They become, but when their heyday, they had no following in Europe at all. They never even toured Europe because they had no following. And in the States, they were massive. Like in 73, 74, they were the biggest American band in the country.
Yeah, for sure.
So it's
funny how it works, you know. You never know. It's you have to work really hard, you know, and promote yourself. It's all about the promotion, and it's not the quality of the music as we know. You know, those guys were fantastic, you know.
Oh yeah, unbelievable.
You have to find the right guy that can bring you to nice gigs, and you don't have to do a lot of gigs, you know. If you're good, it goes quite quick.
Mm.
Yes.
In my book, if you're good enough, those guys were okay anyway, you know.
Yeah.
Right. You're going to have a big following somewhere. It may not be the whole world, but there's definitely places that you're going to be, if you're good enough, that you're going to be.
Big. Yeah, for sure. So there's a lot of more opportunities now that we're speaking, you know, over this podcast, you know, and, it's everything helps, you know. When we started with Snakes in Paradise, we had nothing. We had a paper.
Right.
You know, And yeah, it's not easy to find those papers, you know,
yeah,
and find the number where you're in, and this is much simpler, you know.
Yeah, for sure.
Now, in the 80s, you used to write. I mean, I used to do, because I was always a nut for trying to get, you know, contacts all over the world to get my hands on music I didn't have. You used to write letters, you know. You couldn't even make long distance phone calls because the long distance calls were astronomical. You'd be on the phone for an hour with somebody, it cost you like $300. So you used to write. I mean, I'm talking like even the late 80s. It was still early 90s, still writing letters to people in England and France and Germany. And so just over the course of 30 years, the way you could promote yourself and, you know, is just completely, completely changed.
Yeah, yeah. And that's fantastic with the new technique. You know, it's great.
Yeah.
I
was going to say, so let's move on to like the early 2000s. We just talked about some guys, Allman Brothers, Rory Gallagher, some iconic musicians. You had the chance to work with some really British, iconic British musicians. Talk about the band Company of Snakes, or the Company of Snakes. Mickey Moody, Bernie Marsden, Neil Murray, right? Talk about that, how you got involved with that project and that band.
Yeah, it's funny that you mention it, you know. They told me they were really massive fans of Allman Brothers, you know. They wanted Whitesnake to sound like Allman Brothers.
Really?
Wow. Huh.
Yeah. And, you know, Mickey Moody with a slide guitar, mm-hmm, it's like Dwayne Allman. And so Dwayne was a massive influence for Mickey Moody. And if you listen to those early Whitesnake albums, it's very soulish and
yes,
rock and rollish. So you can hear the influences, you know. I got in touch. I did a gig with, it went quite fast. I did a cover gig in a small island outside of Stockholm called Åland. And, there was a guy there who wanted to meet me to sing, on his rock opera, but, I wasn't sure I was going to do it, you know, but 5 years later, to cut a long story short, he phoned me up, you know, and he ended up as an engineer in Hamburg, and he was mixing an album down there, and he said, you know, this is the Company of Snakes, you know, the old Whitesnake guys. It's more Whitesnake than Whitesnake.
Yeah, which is
so. So he said, you know, they have a problem with the singer, and the singer at the time was the guy from Michael Schenker, Gary Barden. And he had a bad day on a gig, you know. And eventually I flew down to Hamburg and I did an audition for them. And the record company guy called Rainer Hansel played it over the phone to Bernie Marsden, who was in the UK. He played Slow and Easy, whatever it was. And they said, yeah, do you want to come to Norway and play the Hell Blues Festival? So I went there. Yeah, sure. And I went there, and the lineup was Don Airey on keyboards, Neil Murray on bass, Mickey Moody, Bernie Marsden, and John Lingwood. So we had dinner and a small acoustic rehearsal, and then we just did the gig, you know, and I never looked back.
There you go.
We recorded one live album, and we recorded a studio album. I think the studio album was almost live, you know, it was same months, you know, so it was very quickly, you know, so we released it and we recorded everything on the autumn 2000, and then the album got released somewhere in March 2001 or something,
right?
So we did a lot of shows there in the beginning, you know. We did, and Don Airey was with us as well. And after a while, I got the phone call from Deep Purple.
There you go. Yeah.
Because John Lord couldn't, he had some problems, you know, health problems.
Right.
And but it got me to play with the original lineup, you know, with John Lord and Ian Pace.
Mm.
We did one show with the original lineup, Whitesnake.
Okay.
It was on the Norway. my first gig, I met a guy called Tony Ashton. His best friend was John Lord. So
they did an album together back in the day, Ashton Ward.
Ashton Lord Pace, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And Bernie Marsden was the lead singer and guitarist in that band. I don't think the album, it's a great album, actually, if you check it out, you know.
It's a good album. It didn't sell. I don't know how it did over in Europe. It didn't do well in the States at all, that album.
It didn't sell so much. It might have had to do with the promotion, but the album is... Tony was quite a character. He wrote a song called Resurrection Shuffle for Elvis, you know.
Really?
And Tony Ashton, he also came up with a name for Derek and the Dominoes.
Wow.
Really?
Yeah. He was drinking beer and Eric Clapton asked him for a good band name. You know, well, take Derek and the Dominoes, man.
Wow. And you know Dwayne Allman was one of the Dominoes.
Yeah. Sure. And I met Tony he was the star on Friday in Norway. He sang and he played organ. Real Hammond organ, B3. And me and Don Airey played Whitesnake songs with the same guys, the Company of Snakes, on Saturday. So I met him, actually, and when we spoke a bit. A couple of months later, he passed away in cancer. And, Tony was a fantastic musician, you know. He was one of the main characters also for Butterfly... Butterfly Ball,
right.
You know.
Mm. Roger Glover had put that together, right?
Yeah. And anyway, so he passed away in cancer, and we played at it. We did a reunion with the Whitesnake guys on his memorial concert. So it was John Lord and Ian Pace and the rest of the guys, you know.
Wow.
It was a fantastic vibe. Mm.
Wow.
Yeah.
What was it like to play with those guys? You're with two of the classic guys of all time, John Ward and Ian Pace. That had to be some thrill.
Yeah, it was a thrill. John had a little problem with a organ, you know, we didn't have any rehearsals, you know. Bernie said to me, you know, we're not going to rehearse, you know. It was always like that, you know. We had no rehearsals, you know.
Really?
Neil Murray is quite an early bird, you know. He goes up very early. So we went up early to get to the gig, and I knew, okay, we're going to play with John Lord and Ian Pace, but we're not going to get a rehearsal. So I woke up around 5 o'clock, you know, and I was a bit hungry, you know, and it was raining outside. And I was going down to the theater, you know, looking for some catering. And eventually, so I heard this band playing, you know, and I heard through the door, and I went in and went up the stairs. And as soon as I got up the stairs, I saw I was on the stage. So I looked in, and there were the guys playing, you know, rehearsing. And when I looked in, you know, Neil Murray starts to wave me in, you know, and I just woke up, you know, and I didn't say hi or anything. It started with Walking in the Shadow of the Blues, but doon 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 doon. Pace hit the song out and he said, too fast. One more time. And then we went on again, and then John Lord started to turn his back towards me, you know. And I eventually played a song through Walking in the Shadow of the Blues. I'm walking in the shadow of the blues. And I went to John Lord to say hi. First I went to Pace and said, hi, Pace, nice to play with you. Oh, hi, Steph. How you doing, mate? And then I went to John, and he was, you know, working with his organ or something. I said, hi, John, I'm Stefan Bergen, you know. And Don turns around and says, oh, hi, Steph, the organ broke down. So the organ broke down. I was a bit worried about it. You know, is it going to, I mean, John Lord without a Hammond organ?
Right, sure.
What's it going to sound like, you know? But there's a clip on my YouTube channel or on YouTube, and Do you think I need to be worried about John Lord? Mm. No. The only thing you can hear was the fucking organ, you know?
Right.
So it was, and he played so well. You know, he played. There's a clip when he played a solo in "Ain't No Love in the Heart of the City," and he plays those fingers, man. The good play. Mm. I tell you that.
Well, in my opinion, the best period of Whitesnake is when Pace and Ward were in the band. That's what I really like. That to me, that was real Whitesnake. The stuff that went over in the States in the mid to late 80s, it was good, but I never looked at it as white. I looked at Whitesnake as those two guitar players, Moody and Marsden, and when he had Pace and Ward in the band, to me, it was perfection.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, if you want that swing in a John Lord Hammond organ, you know, it doesn't get any better than that musicians-wise, you know. I mean, John Sykes did a really good job on the 87 album. Sure. And it was Neil Murray who played bass on that. So, but it became more metal. Mm. I didn't like the 87 album so much in the beginning, but you have to give David credit, you know, because it sold 100
millions.
Million copies.
Oh, millions. Yeah. Millions of albums.
So he did the right choice.
Yeah. I mean, he also did reuse some of the songs that were from that vintage period. I mean, you know, like the thing with, again, talking about bands that could make it in certain areas, Whitesnake never made it over here at all from that period. So when that album came out, there was a large sector of the American public that thought that was like the first Whitesnake album. They weren't even aware of all that other stuff like somebody like myself was. So that got put to the American public like this is, you know, like a very American sounding metal-ish type of album with the singer from Deep Purple. But most people had no idea that there were all these albums, you know, from the 70s and early 80s in the United States. And the sound was so markedly different, you know, it was easy. It was almost like they pulled the wool over the eyes of the American public that this was like really a classic blues rock band that had albums out for years. And now we're, you know, putting a little bit of eye makeup on Coverdale, doing his hair differently and, you know, selling it as a package, as, you know, as a sex symbol type of singer with this, you know, very American looking band who in fact weren't even Americans really.
Yeah. I mean, it was still John Sykes playing the guitars on the 87 album, you know,
right.
He looked pretty cool, you know, what can you say? But in those days, hair was important.
Yes.
Yeah.
No, it was. It was. It was
all about image.
Especially in America, because you already had the big explosion of, you know, of the Bon Jovi album in 86, which kind of totally set the tone for not only that sound, but the look. So you had to have, like, from 86 going forward, you had to have the look, you know.
It was very important. I'll tell you that, man.
Yeah. So
it's ridiculous when you think about it, you know. It should be music should always come first, you
sure
know, and then the look, you know. It's not bad to look good.
No, I mean, I think you should. I think as any performing artist should do the best they can to present themselves to the public, but it shouldn't be the difference maker. You're right, the music should always be the difference maker.
Yeah,
for sure. I wasn't too happy about Coverdale's. I guess no one was, but too happy about the choice of getting rid of John Sykes. You know, he helped him a lot, you know, with those songs, you know.
And, sure.
I mean, Here I Go Again, Fool for Loving, or Crying in the Rain were old songs. So, I mean, it was a great band, you know, lineup, you know, but my personal favorite Whitesnake lineup was the old guys, you know,
sure,
that I played with, and also with Cozy Powell and John Sykes.
Yeah.
That was pretty powerful too.
Well, that was the first album where the sound started to get a little heavier, but it stayed to the roots of the previous band. You know, we brought in Cozy and Sykes. You could see that video from
Unslided In.
From Recorded in Japan. And that it was, with Neil Murray on bass, who had a huge sound. That was a terrific band. He really should have kept that band together, but
It's not easy to keep those guys together.
No, I mean, evidently Cozy was a guy that he did a lot of changing up along the way.
Yeah. Same with John Lord. And it's not, those guys are not so easy to handle, you know.
No, they're not easy to handle, and they're always in demand. I mean, Ian Paice was, there was a period of time he was so in demand. I mean, he was in Gary Moore's band at pretty much the same time he was in Whitesnake. And, you know, everybody wanted those guys. They were the cream of the cream.
Yeah, for sure. I played with Ian Paice just a couple of years ago. We did a couple of Purple tracks.
Really?
And we also played some Chicago songs.
Really?
26 or 5 to 4 or something.
Wow.
And strange. It was the Don Airey Rock and Blues Festivals. We did a couple of songs.
Interesting.
Well, you know, that's Purple. Hmm. So that was fun, you know. Paice is a unique drummer, I'll tell you that, you know.
Yeah.
Yes, very unique.
It's very unique.
Definitely out of that Buddy Rich school of jazz drumming, you know, super fast hands on the snare drum. He had a very unique sound. A lot of those guys did. Bonham had a unique sound. Carl Palmer, Lee Kerslake, a guy that you're very familiar with, I put right up there with those guys. They were all, a lot of the British drummers were very unique because they were from that era where they learned under jazz musicians. You know, the eras after that, guys were learning how to play rock. Those guys were of the era with their age that they had to learn jazz because rock was in its infancy. So they all had super fast hands and they were all had very definable sounds.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we did an album with Lee Kerslake, The Sun Has Gone Hazy, with Berglund Kerslake Band. And I didn't want to put any triggers or anything on Lee's drums. You didn't need to do that.
Right.
And immediately you got the Aussie sound, you got the Uriah Heep style of drumming, exactly what I wanted, you know. So it's it was fantastic. He had his unique style, you know.
Well, let's talk about that because I was going to bring that up next when we were talking earlier. The Berggren Kerslake Band. Lee Kerslake with yourself. How did that all come about? That was 2014. You put the album out, The Sun Has Gone Hazy. So how did that all come about?
Yeah, we were, he was touring with Uriah Heep, and it was coming to the end of the line. And I was out with M3, Classic Whitesnake. We had a new drummer called Jimmy Copley. And we met in a bar down there. We met some guys from Switzerland. And we did some shows down in Switzerland, just flew down and did some Uriah Heep numbers, and we did some Whitesnake songs and some Aussie songs, you know. And eventually he phoned me up and said he had a gig in Helsinki, just a duo, you know. And it was a company gig, you know, it was me on acoustic guitar and Lee on congas, you know, and the show went down really well. And after the gig, the day after the show, we had a 5 hours to the flight back, you know, to Stockholm. And we ended up in a friend's place, which they had guitars and they had, different instruments, you know, and we just sat down and had a glass of wine and we started. I was thinking, you know, this, he was a little bit stressed out. So I was thinking, you know, this might be the last time I see him, you know, and I was, had a couple of glasses of wine and I said, Lee, man, I got some riffs for you, man. So I played him the Walk Tall riff, you know, and, we started to sing and jam together. We wrote about 7 songs in 1 hour.
Wow.
So it was, it clicked, you know, it was pure magic, you know, and I decided there and then we decided to do an album together, you know, and I flew him over to Stockholm I couldn't fly him out for, you know, to have him stay in my house for a month, you know. It took quite a long time to write the album, and it took quite a long time to produce it, you know, the way we wanted it, you know, we and record it properly. I mean, we recorded the drums and in only 3 days, but I flew them over for one day, and we did four songs in the studio, and then we did a gig, you know, to cover the costs. Mm. So I had to do it over a month, 2 months period or something. So it's it was we record most of the stuff live, you know, in the studio without click track or anything, and it was a great singer as well, Lee. So he did a lot of BVs on the background on the album, and he also sings a little bit here and there, you know. So he was a big part of the Uriah Heep background vocals, you know.
If you look at those videos from back in the like the early to mid 70s when he was in the band, he sang a lot. I mean, you know, like Byron always gets like all the recognition, but you know, he had Hensley and Kerslake sang a lot to enhance his voice and, you know, all the choruses. And that's what really made that band. You know, they had like three guys that were like real good singers. I mean, Kerslake has a real good voice, and obviously so does Ken Hensley, and David Byron goes without saying. Yeah.
He told me it was, you know, it was more like a barbershop thing. You know, they also had the vibratos, you know.
Yes. Yes. And that was the classic Uriah Heep sound.
Always slow vibrato, you know.
Right. What you just did, that was the classic Uriah Heep vocal in so many different songs.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's where it came from, because you had three guys that were really singing lead at the same time.
Yeah. And Ken Hensley was a fantastic singer as well.
So. Yes. Oh, yeah. I mean, he was
great songwriter, you know. It's
fabulous. Fabulous.
It was an honor to work with Lee. You know, we wrote the songs together, you know, in the same room at the same time, you know. So lyric-wise and melodies, you know, and it was... The wine was flowing. Uriah Heep is known for quite a party band.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, to the detriment of some of them, but yeah, without a doubt. Byron was one of the biggest losses in the rock community, what happened to him, because there was a period of time that he was up here.
You mean Dave Byron?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, he was up there in the, you know, in the Robert Plant category. He was that good.
Fantastic.
Yeah,
it's they still hold up. It's very good. Those old albums, you know, Demons and Wizards.
Demons and Wizards, to me, I could put that on now, and I get the same rush that I got when I bought it as like a 14-year-old kid. It hasn't aged at all in 50 years. It's just incredible. In fact, I think I have even more appreciation for it now than I did then because of my age, you know?
Yeah, I think Wasp did a cover of Easy Living.
Oh, the Wasp covered it, yeah.
Yeah, so it's pretty cool.
Wasp did a good job with it, considering that the song itself was a masterpiece, but Wasp did they put their stamp on it, you know?
Yeah, for sure, It's funny how it works that way, but I mean, Uriah Heep was massive back in the day, you know?
Yes.
It's a great band. It's the only original guy left is...
Is Mick.
Mick, yeah.
Yeah, it's been Mick's gig for, you know, a long time now. But he was one of these guys that was able to recreate that band in so many different, you know, eras. Mm-hmm. You know, like the era that they had, like in the Abominog era, rivaled the original band. And that was like a decade already passed from the original band. You know, he had Lawton in it a long period of time, and he's just recreated that band 20 times over, and always successfully.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. He's a fantastic guy. He's probably one of the nicest guys in show business. Well, you know, he's a really cool guy, Mickey Box, you know, and the band is great, you know.
Yeah, I just got to see them last year.
Yeah, I sang two shows with Uriah Heep.
Really?
We did a show with Don Airey a couple of years ago, and Uriah Heep was supporting they played before us, you know. We had a really late spot, you know. And we had the new guitar, the purple guitar, Simon McBride, playing with us as well. And it was Darren Mooney, great drummer from Primal Scream. And Lawrence Cutley, who plays on Headless Cross. And
He played the fretless bass.
He played with the Clapton and those guys, you know, Jeff Beck. And they stood and watched the gig and they said, fucking hang, man. And the singer had to go in for an operation. So he was a bit sick for a while, you know. What's his name now? Bernie Shaw, yeah.
Yeah, Bernie Shaw, who dated way back into the early 80s with a band called Stratus. He was in and out of Praying Mantis for a while, too. Before he landed,
been with Uriah Heep. With Uriah Heep forever now, it seems.
I think, yeah, since like probably the 85-ish, I think. Yeah. 85, 86.
So he had to go in for an operation. He was quite, you know, sick.
I had heard that, yeah.
We did two shows, you know, and then he came back. So he recovered quickly, you know.
Now, going back a little bit, you were in, I guess it was a side project called Four Sticks. I remember the CD. It came out as a promotional CD. I don't know whether, did it ever come out on a label or it was kind of just like an independent thing you did?
We were, at the time, I was with the Warner Brothers, you know, and they paid for the recordings and they printed the CD as well. We had a... It wasn't a promotional thing, actually. It was a proper stuff, you know. We recorded it on tape, and then we mastered some. In those days, there were no, you know, computers. We wanted this honesty as well, you know. And that album got released again in New York in a record label called Grooveyard Records in New York.
Oh, that's, I was going to say, that's a New York based. I had no idea that got released. Cause I have, I guess, which was the very first copy of it. Like it has promotional, you know, don't know, but it's here. It's here. I'm actually, I can show you. It
flew over the pond, you know,
and it's got promotional stamped all over
it. Promotion
only. Yeah. Even on the spine, promotional. So I was always curious whether it, you know, and now you're telling me it came out on Grooveyard Records, which is,
It New came York. Out on Grooveyard Records. So he,
with your permission, I'm assuming.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
I have all the songs. A friend of mine had a tape machine and we copied it from over into the computer, the files, but we remixed one or two songs. So on the new print, there's a new mix that I did from some leftovers that we had left on that album. And it was apparently it was his favorite album, so he wanted to do a new release on it. So we released it again in 2015 or something.
And it's got songs on it that weren't on this original one?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm going to have to look into it.
I have one more extra as well. So there were two leftovers, but only one made it to the album.
Okay.
Yeah. And we did, we were supposed to do a new album on that as well, but it turned into a Swedish, we changed the name to it. It's called Prince Svart.
Okay.
Yeah. Prince Black, but it's in Sweden. It's called Prince Svart, what do you say? We did two more albums, the same lineup on same as Four Sticks, exactly the same, but we sing in Swedish.
Ah, okay.
So it's
a. It's a little bit of a curveball, yeah.
Yeah, it's a little curveball. You can't understand the lyrics unless you teach Swedish, you know.
But. Well, I'm a big fan of Japanese metal, so I'm used to having albums that I really like and listen to and have no idea what the fuck they're singing. So if I could hack the Japanese, I could.
I mean, Rammstein, you know, they sing in German.
No, not my style of music, but I'm well aware of the fact that they sing in German. But I was into all those Japanese metal bands back in the day, and most of them were in English, but
But if you want to see the continuation about the 4/6, go and check out Prince Svart.
Now, what was your decision to do it in Sweden?
Two more albums on that lineup, you know.
Why was that your decision to do it in Swedish as opposed to English?
It wasn't my decision, actually, because I wanted to do a new 4/6 album. And the guitarist, he likes to study languages, you know, and okay. I don't know. He got some strange vibe, you know. He might have had some lyrics lying around or something. But he wanted to do something different, you know. And to me, it was a bit weird, I have to tell you that, at first. But it came out pretty good. So it's we became quite popular fast in Sweden.
Okay.
But only in Sweden.
Well, I was going to say, that's the good part. The bad part is it would probably turn off every other area of the world.
Yeah, that's. I was thinking the same, you know.
So, I would think, yeah.
I mean, in the end, you have to sell the records, you know, and it's easier especially for me, who's been living in the UK for, you know, 10 years,
right?
And I also went over to America a couple of times, you know, and I mean, it's. I don't mind singing in Sweden. I don't mind singing in English as well. You know, it's. It's quite natural.
Mm. I wanted to talk to you about another band that you were in with a guitar player that I've always followed his whole career by the name of Ralph Monks, Razorback. How did that All right. come about?
Now he was working a bit with Neil Murray, and he came to see us with the M3 Classic Whitesnake, you know, and. The Company of Snakes, so he was always around. But when we were touring Germany, and we toured Germany a lot, and we toured the rest of Europe, you know, and UK many times over the years. I was with that band, you know, for on and off for 10 years, you know. And he came around, and he was thinking about doing a new band, and he worked with Neil and asked Neil if he had any good singers, you know. So he said, Stefan Bergen can sing it, you know, if you want. And in those days, it was a little bit of metal. I think it was around 2003, 2004, 2007,
you know. Yeah.
And it started to be quite much metal, you know. Mm-hmm. And we were trying to do some German power metal thing, you know. It was quite big at the time during the festival. So, I mean, he's a metal guitarist as well,
yes.
So.
Yes, he's always been associated with that. And he's used American singers. I mean, he's always used like some of the better singers in the scene. So like your voice would definitely fit in with what I've always known him to do is kind of like more like Americanized type of metal with like very strong singers and his guitar.
Yeah, he worked a little bit with Tony Martin.
Tony Martin, yep. I think Lance King was in his band for a while.
Okay, yeah. He did. We did a tour with Razorback, and on the last album, it was Mike Tirano who played the drums. You know, great drummer.
Right, exactly. The last release, yeah. Mike Tirano, yeah. Now Mike Tirano was in Axel Rudi's Pelz band for a long time.
All right.
And yeah. Ralph Monks, I think, always did music that was kind of similar to Axel Rudi Pell, you know, like that European metal with a lot of, you know, American singers or UK singers, kind of cut out of that same mold. But those Razorback albums are really good. I mean, they've spanned it a long period of time between the three records, and they've all been steadily, in my opinion, real strong albums.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, on the first album, we had the drummer from Accept. It was Stefan Kaufmann who played the drums on the first CD. And on the last one, it was...
Tirana.
I can't remember. Tirana, yeah. Yeah, and on tour after the last album in Germany, it went out pretty good. The songs were really good, you know, very powerful. Yeah, I also played the guitar. So it was quite a good band. We had the... Danny Needham on the drums. He plays drums with Venom now.
Right.
Venom?
Mm-hmm.
No, it was a great band, you know. But I guess a role fell out of or something with the other guitars, you know, they fell apart, you know.
Ah, okay.
So, and around 2007, I started to work with Lee, you know, doing those gigs in Switzerland. So, I was more interested in going solo and work a little bit with Lee, you know. And I also had Mickey Mooney and Bernie Marsden coming over to Stockholm, you know. We did a couple of shows here. It was great, you know, great players.
Hmm. I kind of wanted to wrap up with one more project you were in called Revolution Road.
Yeah, that was a request from Alexander Del Vici. It was great band, you know. He wanted to do a Snakes in Paradise thing, you know. It's a bit pastiche, you know. But it's nothing wrong with that, you know. And great players, you know. He was the producer for Frontiers.
Yeah, for a lot of years. Yeah.
Frontiers Records, you know.
He was the complete backbone for Frontiers Records. Between songwriting and playing and producing and signing. And yeah.
Yeah. I didn't know that, you know. I thought he was a keyboard player. So, I mean, we wrote some songs together and he had a couple of tracks, you know. And I brought in a couple of the guys from Snakes in Paradise to make it more Snakes in Paradise sound. It sounds pretty good, you know. I mean, it's a bit modern, you know. I kind of like it more honest.
Mm.
I have to say it's a bit slick for me. I'm not sure. It's super tight. I don't know what's the reason for that. But it sounds like it's some songs sound pretty good, you know.
I think it's a good album. I mean, it's kind of cut out of the Snakes in Paradise mold, but like you said, with the more, I guess, more of an AOR slant to it, you know, like slicker.
More modern sounding.
Yeah,
you know?
A more modern AOR slant, you know, which Del Vecchio has been involved in a lot of bands like that.
Now they're all good guys, you know, all good players, and they did a good job.
No, it's a good album. I like it, yeah.
But it wasn't on Frontiers. It wasn't another label. It was
I actually have the Japanese copy here, and it was on Rubicon. Rubicon out of Japan. I don't know what the European release was, but Rubicon put it out. And Rubicon generally doesn't do the Frontiers Japanese stuff. In fact, they don't do it. It's another label. So, yeah, it was definitely not a Frontiers thing.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, it's good that it's still around, those CDs. And I released a couple of vinyl albums, you know, and I like it. I kind of prefer... It's good to have, you know, streaming, but it's also good to have LP.
Physical product. Yeah. I mean, Mark and myself have never moved off a physical product. I was brought up on it, and to me, I can't digest an album unless I have the physical product in my hand, because I have to see who produced it. I have to see who played on it. I have to develop a connection to the music. I can't just listen to something. I could appreciate something's good, but I have to be able to read the booklet and see what's what, and then I could listen to it. It's old school.
And the sound is really good on a CD, and it's also good on an LP. You know? So sure. It's a CD player in my car. You know?
Yeah,
and I like that. You know, it's the sound is much better than streaming. You know.
Yeah.
I think the quality is better on CD.
I do too. Yeah. I've never understood the big resurgence in vinyl, because I grew up on vinyl that was loaded with clicks and pops and skips. And now all of a sudden people want that. Oh, you have to hear the hiss. And, you know, it's good to hear background noise. No, I don't think so. I hated it. I would have to go to buy a record sometimes 3 and 4 times over before you got a clean copy that didn't have some click or pop or skip in it. And when CDs came out, I to this day, it's the greatest invention for me, that you could listen to music.
I was completely shocked when it came, you know.
I've been shocked by it too, that people want to go back to something that I viewed as totally inadequate compared to a CD, but.
No, it's both are good. I think I had, I mean, it's not a big difference between a LP or CD, you know. They're quite different. It's rounder sound on a LP, but it's very hard to take a LP in the car, you know.
Yeah,
and granted, the other difference is the way they're making vinyl today is vastly different than how they made it when I was a kid. I mean, now they make it, it's like this thick. And, you know, records that we used to buy back in the day, they were paper thin. And now they put so much time and effort into making these extra grade vinyls and how many grams. And, you know, the vinyl was way, way higher quality than what it was years ago.
I think you don't have to have thick vinyl. I did 180 grams myself.
Oh, you did?
But it's, I mean, it's great. But one of my favorite LPs is Innuendo by Queen, you know. And it's just a simple cover. It's just very thin, but it sounds great. Hmm. You don't, I mean, it's very, it's not so good for transportation. If you want to sell any, right. any, LPs on the gigs, you know, you have to pay extra for the amount, you know. That's CDs right. are good to take with you in the bag or something, but LPs can be very tricky, you know.
Mm, that's true. That's a good point.
You have to have a bus.
Yeah.
Right.
well, let's come full circle because we started with Snakes in Paradise and we talked a little bit about it before we started the show. You mentioned that there is maybe something new in the pipeline.
Yeah, the band is right now on ice, but we'll see. We have I discovered some old recordings in Snakes in Paradise. It might be 10 songs that hasn't been released yet. Mm. So that's a good starting point, you know. I was thinking about remixing them, and we got some leftovers from the last album as well. We couldn't fit them in, you know. I think we had. At least an album is going to be 20 songs or something.
Wow.
So, but it's also good to write some new stuff. I'm working a bit with one of the guitarists there. We're going to play some gigs together in the summertime.
Okay.
His name is Jackie Thompson, you know, and we will see, you know, if the time is right and we get a good label or something. And right off, we can do it. It takes that band is quite complicated because we live very far apart, so we can't. I mean, it's a nightmare with transportation. You know,
right?
We have to fly in everyone and get hotels and stuff. But you can do a lot of things online. But I like meeting people and write at the same time. But it takes a long time. But we have a. I have to say one thing with the Snakes in Paradise, about Snakes in Paradise, we have very easy to write good songs, you know, and it's always good quality and goes fast, you know.
Mm.
So, but it's quite complicated. People in the band have had personal problems, you know, but it's gotten better, you know, and everyone slows down in the end, you know.
Mm.
So.
Yeah.
So I guess we have to do one more.
That's right. Right. One more.
I mean, it was a starting thing, you know, with Frontiers, and it was quite complicated to do that album, but in the end, it turned out quite good, you know. But now it could get even better, you know.
Mm. Yeah.
All right.
Was there anything else,
no.
Tom?
No. All good.
No. Well, Stefan, it was great talking to you today. We appreciate your time. Some good stories. We'll keep an eye out, even though it might be a little more in the future, but we'll look for a new Snakes in Paradise, hopefully at some point, whether it's new, old material, but yeah, that'd be great.
I have one more thing. I'm working with a guy from Birmingham, Alabama. His really? Name is Alan Cotton. So we're doing an album this year. It's American hard rock, you know.
Hmm. Is there a name for that?
It's the Cotton Berggren Band.
Okay.
We have I can't say too much right about now, but the album has been recorded, and we're going to tweak it a little bit, you know. He's a great guy. The songs turn out great. I've already done the vocals, so it's done. I think they put it on some bass guitar right now. And also I'm working on a new solo album.
Okay. This will be number three?
Number three. If you don't count the Berggren Kerslake Band, you know.
Right.
I'm still working, you know.
You gotta keep going, that's for sure.
I just do. I have a couple of gigs coming up, you know, and I also met Don Airey. He was here and we spoke about doing some festivals together, you know. And
wow.
I might bring in Neil Murray on bass for the solo stuff and perhaps Don on a couple of tracks, you know.
Nice. Awesome. Wow.
I'm in contact with those guys. But watch out, guys. It's going to soon be released, you know, some stuff.
Excellent. Good stuff.
Great news.
All right. Well, Stefan, we appreciate it. Everybody, Stefan Berggren from multiple bands. We talked about them all tonight. But thank you for your time tonight. We appreciate it.
Thanks very much. Take care.
All right.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Cheers. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
See you.
I told you I missed you, would you take it to heart? Would you play my